And now, talking to the boyhood heroes who became his broadcasting colleagues, this is My Radio 1 with Sean
Tilly. From its launch in 1967, right through the 70s to the mid-80s, BBC Radio 1 was probably the world's biggest music station. In this series, I'm introducing you to many of the people behind the network's success during those golden years, as they each tell the story of their Radio 1. And it is an honour, a thrill to welcome the network's longest-serving DJ, who needs no introduction really, well, unless she does it herself. Sean
Tilly. My Radio 1. Used to be, I would just say, hi, and there was a reason for that. Maybe we'll come to it later. Now I say, hey, hi, hello.
We will come to that again, Annie. It's so lovely to see you. Thanks so much for coming on to My Radio 1. Yeah. So I'm guessing it was your background as a journalist that first got you into broadcasting.
Well, it was. And the thing was, it was all very well sort of describing a record that you were crazy about in words, but you really wanted to play it to people. You wanted to, you know, discover something wonderful. You want to play it down the phone to your mate and go, I've just heard this, have a listen. And then say, well, what do you think of that? And basically, it's forever been like that. And I fell in love with the pirates. I fell in love with the whole romantic notion of pirate radio. And I'd be sitting in my house in Brighton on the balcony, listening to Radio Caroline and watching the ship go past on the horizon.
Really?
And that was my moment. Yeah. I thought, this, oh God, I would love to do this. Because that was pretty impossible. Mm. I'm going to swim out and join them. but, you know, that's when I had my Damascene moment.
But it was in 1964, obviously, when the pirates emerged, that you made your BBC radio debut. It was on Woman's Hour, on the old Light programme.
What had happened was, I was working on a local paper in Brighton, very happy, really enjoyed it. And somebody who was a local councillor, actually, said to me, oh, the BBC are looking for a regional reporter. And I didn't know that I was exactly in something that I was really going to shine at. But once I sat, and then I sat in a studio in Brighton in the Royal Pavilion, with that extraordinary ornate palace where there was a BBC studio, there might be still one there, a little unmanned studio with a microphone, a pair of headphones, and a kind of wind-up thing. And then someone would speak to you from Bristol, and then you'd read out your piece. And I thought, nah, this, it felt right. It felt like something I could do. It just felt very natural to me. And I'd grown up listening to the BBC. I'd been at college literally around the corner from Broadcasting House, but it never crossed my mind that I'd ever work for the BBC, because it seemed very remote and daunting. And the only women in it were people with names like Grace Wyndham Goldie, and they were all very double-barreled ladies' names. And they were, and so, but once I got that taste for it, then I was trying to find a way in. So, yeah, if I could do a little piece for Woman's Hour or something like that. There were no DJs. I mean, we had probably, was Alan Freeman arrived by then? I'm not sure.
Mm, yeah, David Jacobs, Pete Murray.
Yeah, but yeah, David Jacobs. And then I was on Jukebox Jury.
I know.
So I was on. So what happened was, I took off on TV. I had my own TV series on Radio Fusion. It was a sister show to Radio City Go. And I was so, you know, I wasn't the like, sidekick, weather girl, any of that. It was like my show. And I was picking bands and saying, oh, there's this band called the Yardbirds. I think we should have one. And then they'd be, well, massive. And that, but it wasn't the same success as Radio City Go. So that got taken off. But now I'd got a thing for about TV as well. Yeah. And TV had been much easier. But, you know, you didn't know what it was going to lead to. And so, obviously, then the pirates happened and that made the music wonderful. Then we know what happened. The pirates got outlawed. And then Radio 1 began. And I actually thought, oh, Radio 1 will be a watered-down version of the pirates. It cannot be as good. I was quite resentful about being Radio 1 replacing the excitement of all the pirate DJs. And then I thought, well, maybe I could be one of them.
Let me talk to you about the beginning of Radio 1 then. Considering that you'd had television experience
at the
sharp end, right?
Yeah.
You'd had your own summer series in 66 on the Light programme, which is Melody Fair.
Did I? No, I don't even remember that.
Now, that's amazing. You don't even remember that. So by 1967, when the network launched, I would have thought you were in pole position, albeit coming at it from a slightly different angle to all the pirate DJs that joined the BBC. Mm. Why is it that Radio 1 didn't have you in there from the beginning?
Because
that seems like such a mistake to
me. I'm glad you see it that way. At the time, I thought about this so much and thought, why was this blanket ban on women? And they said, this jockey's a husband substitutes. Can you believe that? I mean, I've had a big laugh at Cambridge Union, I think, about that, but it was true. And I think they thought that all that first run of DJ had to be somebody for... They thought that all the women were home doing the ironing and doing the washing up, and that they were all little happy little housewives, and that they wanted a substitute for their hubby who was at the office or at the factory or whatever. And that's what they thought. And we're now reaching, like, the end of the 60s. I was writing for when Cosmopolitan launched... You know, a very feminist magazine. I was writing a music column for them. I was writing for a lot of then girls' magazines, but were quite militant, and Petticoat and Honey and all of those. And I was writing column. I was attacking the BBC because I had a voice to do so, and saying, "What? Yeah, what is it about Radio 1 that they feel they can't possibly have a woman?" Because I felt, you know, I'd been reviewing music for many years by then. I was used to interviewing, you know, all the because living in Brighton, they all came, you know, on a sort of pop circuit. They would all come and play Brighton. Yeah. So it was probably easier than had I been living in London then. So, to me, I couldn't see any reason. And I say, look, if I can have a go, if I'm no good, absolutely fine. I will shut up and go away and stop bothering you. But please, can I just try? And the point was, it was a technical side, like, can you self-op? I didn't even know what that meant. And of course, that was the big difference. Of all the pirate DJs had built their own desks. They'd built the way they were used to operating, and I hadn't got a clue. And I knew that I had to do it that way, because before that, when you had announcers, and there's a big difference between somehow being a DJ, you literally had to ride that record. And if you were somebody else's, fading it out in another suit, it was just never going to sound the same. And so I had to learn, but I had to learn. I was really thrown in the deep end, which I think happens to us.
Yeah, 5th of October 1969, though. It eventually happened. 8:45 in the evening it was, featuring sessions from The Move and Harmony Grass.
Yeah. Well, that first show, I was so terrified. And also, I made the biggest mistake.
What's that?
Obviously, it was vinyl, you know, so his records going round and round. I thought, well, I'll do something useful while that's happening. So I'll press stop, you know. And then there was like, they're there. And we all know that that is worst crime possible, dead air. Nobody could figure out what had happened. I could be so stupid as to stop the record that was being broadcast. So I thought, well, that's it. They gave me my opportunity and I've blown it. But obviously, they were quite forgiving.
Yeah, they certainly were.
Because I had nowhere else to learn. And you had to learn on air, and you had one show a week. And so it's a bit like having driving lessons, that what you'd learn 1 week, you'd probably have forgotten half of it by the next week. So it took me a huge amount of time. And I wasn't nervous about the talking side of it. I was nervous of making technical mistakes. I really was. I mean, a lot of instances were, you know, playing things at the wrong side or the wrong speed or playing the album version, which had the swearing in it, and playing Star by the Rolling Stones, which everybody else knew what they were saying. I just come back from holiday. I didn't know. They thought it was the best thing ever happened. The producer was suspended for 2 weeks. Bernie Andrews, very famous, helped me more than anyone ever. A wonderful guy. To make his point, he would stop people in the street where he lived and say, excuse me, could you come in my house for a minute? I want you to listen to this record and tell me if you can hear anything, you know, untoward in the lyrics. And they went, I mean, you wouldn't dream of doing that now. But anyway, they did. And they heard things which weren't there either. He was trying to make the point that if you didn't know that they were saying,
just go over your head,
you wouldn't have known.
Yeah.
And so he nearly got fired over that. So, and he'd been so good to me. I mean, we were friends forever. He helped me. I mean, he went to incredible lengths. So I owe him so much.
And of course, Bernie's going to be coming up later on in your Radio 1 story as well. Mm. But before we get around to that, you're a bona fide Radio 1 DJ in 1970.
Yeah.
And they obviously trusted you a great deal because you were there reviewing the new singles on What's New. Well, and what a thrill. Terry Wogan handing over to you every day.
Yeah. He would make me laugh so much I couldn't speak. And that was his game, you know, in the loveliest way. But he also gave me very good advice. He said, always write out your first link. And it's such good advice because then, you know, if you don't stumble over the beginning, if you make a good, clean start, and I'm sure that applies to every broadcaster. So he was very helpful to me.
The time on Radio 1 is 5 o'clock, and here is Anne Nightingale, as promised, to introduce... let me finish.
Sorry, Terry.
Look, who's the senior man around here?
You are.
Not so senior, though. What's new?
Thank you very much, Terry. Incidentally, I have a friend called Henry. He has a complaint to make about you. He says that he's been fighting off flab ever since you started your whole campaign. He drives along in his car, and as soon as that comes on, he leaps out of his car, side of the road, does all the exercises, and he says he's now put on 4 pounds, Terry.
I thought you were going to tell me he was knocked 40 yards by a passing truck.
But he's putting on weight. What are you going to do about it?
I'm not going to lay a finger on him.
I shouldn't. He's bigger than you, Terry. Enough of this. We better get on with the aid programme. Bye-bye. I'll see you after Christmas. Maybe it is Christmas spirit coming up or something like that. Anyway, welcome to Thursday's What's New. It's the last one of the week this week, and it's all reissues this week. In fact, it's all the rusty oldies today, so I hope you'll enjoy all those.
Certain people were nice to me, Johnny Walker, Emperor Roscoe. They were very supportive, but Stuart Henry was lovely. It was just this massive ego battle going on between them. So I think I was kind of irrelevant to them. I would just be somebody else who would have a slot that they wanted, you know, or something. But those early What's New ones, I mean, the reason... I remember Derek Chinnery said to me once, the only reason we ever took you on is because you used to be a journalist. We don't regard you as a real DJ. So you had to get used to stuff like that.
Well, it did change over a period of time. Let's talk about Roscoe, because it wasn't very long after you started on What's New that you were also appearing on his round table, and you would end up being his deputy on it.
Yeah,
as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I love doing round table.
Anyway, those are my parting words anyway. I did forget
to say goodbye to you now.
Well, in a
second. I'm your deputy, or have been for, I don't know, 3 years or something. May I say...
Come on, Annie.
It's been wonderful working while you weren't there.
Thank you,
and while you were there.
Oh, you're very kind indeed. Now, no tears or anything like that.
No, I can't help it.
There's a lot of drink used to be consumed during those shows. But it was a great show. I mean, obviously, Steve and Matt doing it now on Six Music. It's a great format. You know, great formats like Desert Island Discs, Roundtable, should never leave, you know.
Another mainstay of the Radio 1 schedule was Sounds of the 70s.
Ah, right.
And before long, you were on that as well. You were doing like the review show midweek, weren't
you? The point was, I realised that completely opposite to most DJs who want to be on in the daytime, reviewing records and, you know, for listening back to this now, I mean, I'm very harsh with some of them, but we didn't have an awful lot of great records to play.
Mm.
It would never... It was only there because of the needle time problem.
Yes.
And, you know, now you just take for granted you play what you like. My whole thing has been allowed to play what I want. And from then on, and that has been everything to me. And then gradually, because we really almost still in its early days in those days, but finding their way, what they were doing. And then this whole playlist thing happened, and I thought, well, the whole point I want to be here is not because I want to be a daytime superstar thing, it's because I want to play music that I love. And I thought, these guys in the evening, they play what they want. So I remember saying to the controller, can I be on in the evening? Because that's when, you know, that you get to play what you really want. And they went, yeah, okay.
From Jabra's Ooh La La, not to be confused with the Faces track of the same name. That's on Electro, which is their latest single. I know now why I've sort of slightly fell for it, because there's a lot of phasing in there. And I do seem to be known for being a bit of a sucker for that kind of effect electronically, but it's a marginal improvement. Maybe they're trying to do a sort of big grand funk operation with Jabrath and launch him as the sort of solo version of grand funk, who I think are absolutely terrible, but they seem to have made a great success of that band in America, although they bombed dreadfully when they came here. But this is better. So if they keep on, if rather he, the Jabrath person, keeps on improving, you might end up sounding quite good. But he still sounds too much like Mick Jagger, and he's sort of also doing that very contemporary Cockney voice, which sounds very strange coming from an American.
Such was the profile, of course, back in those days, particularly, and into the 1980s, which is what we remember in this series. The radio station, as we always say, was arguably the biggest music station in the world. With that did come fame. There was, I don't know about a pressure, but there was certainly the management would like you to be out doing road shows and fun days and fun weeks and all that sort of stuff. And of course, the legendary one that you were part of, amongst many others, was Mallory Park in Leicestershire, 1975, with the Bay City Rollers. What's your spin on that?
Oh, the whole, it was absolutely, I'd forgotten that I actually took part in the race around the racetrack.
With me here is Annie Nightingale, the Radio 1 DJ who was driving in the race. Annie, were you the first lady?
I don't think I was. It's all right. I actually haven't found out really what happened yet, except that I remember Stephanie Desykes overtaking me. I thought, oh dear. Bye-bye, Stephanie. And then further on, there's a sort of nasty yellow flag waving. So I slowed down and she'd spun in the middle of the track. So I sort of carefully overtook her again. And that is all I know. I mean, I've only just found out that Cozy Power won because he lapped me very beautifully, but I was complimented on the way I let him pass me.
Did you give him a hand signal, make a polite lady driver?
No, I didn't actually. I didn't know who it was at the time until he was passing me. Then Noel overtook me and I thought, well, I think one can now rule out any possibility of being a winner.
Right.
But it really is, it's an amazing experience. And then my first reaction when I finished was, I want to get in a car and do it again or have another race.
Well, maybe you could do, but better let your little race on your own a little bit later on. Anne Simmons was in it too. How did Anne do, do you know?
I've no idea. I really haven't sort of seen what happened to her, but all the girls appear to be doing very well, and Linda Cunningham, who was also in the race, although because she'd taken me round, she was my instructor earlier on. I'm very encouraged.
She's done quite a bit of it, hasn't she,
Linda? Yeah, she has, so that was very helpful.
So are you going to do some more racing in future?
I'd love to, I must admit. I really understand now why people get so obsessed by it, because this is such an incredible feeling, really. You feel as if you're almost stationary and the ground's moving away from underneath you. I must say, I'm so fascinated to see what next episode of what happens to the Bay City Rollers now marooned in the middle of a lake.
So the setup was, Mallory Park had a sort of racetrack. Inside it was a lake. In the middle of the lake was an island. And on this little island, that's where the Radio 1 studio was set up. And that is where the rollers were going to land by helicopter. And all what happened is that the fans, so desperate to get to them, will first of all risk being run over by racing car racing around the racetrack, ducking and diving in between that, then throwing themselves into the lake. It was wild and memorable. And things like that don't happen now.
You mentioned Bernie Andrews earlier on. It was 1975 when you and Bernie got together again. It was initially the Sunday afternoon request show.
Right.
Yeah, between 3 and 5.
Right. I mean, it's hard to remember. You've got a better take on all these years than I have.
Research, Annie, that's what it is.
It got taken over by students. Well, you know, Sunday afternoon, pre-internet days, who's got a piece of paper and a pen, a pencil? Students have. So if they're hearing, you know, if you write in and you get your record played, they're the most likely probably to respond. And Teddy Warwick, who's the other very helpful person, who's an exec producer, who's sort of head of specialist music, I remember him saying, to me, if you play good music on this show, you will get good requests for good other music. And he was absolutely right.
Give me a ticket for an aeroplane. Ain't got time to take a fast train. Lonely days ago, I'm a going home. My baby just don't put me a letter. My baby just don't put me a letter.
You don't need a Concorde flight or even an intercity express if you want a letter to reach me. Just write to Anne Nightingale, BBC, London, W1A, 4WW.
Initially, it was called the W1A 4WW show.
Well, I wanted to call it that because it was a postcode. Now, when we have the W1A show, I feel completely exonerated.
Mm.
And I think the reason it got not called the W1A 4WW show anymore is because the research would say, stop people in the street, or however they did their research, wouldn't understand what that meant. You had to say it had to be your name. So I think that's the reason you had to have your name in the title. Otherwise, people wouldn't get it, you know.
You were doing other stuff, though, and obviously because you had this background of interviewing people and things like that, mm. Radio 1 was giving you more and more of an opportunity to shine at doing that sort
of
stuff.
Well, I was sort of making those up. You had to always make your opportunities. It didn't come up.
So were you constantly banging on the door?
Absolutely.
Even for something like in 1977, the George Harrison interview, for instance?
Well, that was probably because I was mates with... I'd been mates with the Beatles, I'd been mates with Apple. And Derek Taylor, who was a fabulous, wonderful character, who was... There's a lot of fifth Beatles, you know, like Harry Nilsson and one or two other people called fifth Beatles, but he was, and it was him really that when I was knocking on the door with Radio 1 and they kept going, no, 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 he knew Douglas Muggeridge.
I love this clip, Annie. It's you and George, and obviously the whole thing had gone on with the chiffons, he's so fine, the plagiarism thing. And this is the beginning of part two of that two-part interview that you did with George. And you're having a little bit of fun with it because obviously he's a little bit hacked off because he can hear similarities with Beatles songs all the time. Yeah. So you're playing a little quiz here. Let's have a listen.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, we invite you to join us in a new radio quiz programme, and I hand you over to our host, Mr. George Harrison.
Oh, now it's time to spot the tune. It's quite good fun, really, because I've been doing it for years. Ever since this thing started happening, I could never really understand it because every song I can hear, you know, so many tunes in them. And certain tunes bother me more than others. Like, I'll give you an example. I don't know if you'd like to play the game of spot the tune, but just to show that it's been going on for a long time anyway, the possibility of copyright infringement or using the same notes or the same chord structure or the same guitar lines or even in some cases similar lyrics. You know, there's a point where it's accepted. And most people's music is like that anyway, is the result of their past experiences. And I think in that case anyway, we as individuals and as the Beatles were the ones most ripped off by everybody when it comes down to guitar lines, solos, harmony, and counterpoints, and you know, all that. It does bother me a bit how they don't notice other songs. Because there's songs like, one of them that really drove me crackers was Tie a Yellow Ribbon Round the Old Oak Tree. Which is, you know, tie da 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 da. For I'll be looking for a bluebird. Da 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 da. It's April showers, and then it goes da 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 da. Alone again, naturally.
Now that's interesting because Annie's looking at me there. Although you were listening to that intently, remembering actually doing the interview, you don't recall that part of the conversation, though.
Obviously, you just don't remember. You're making a show every day. It's live, or not every day. Every week or whatever, and you're planning the next one, and you once it's gone out, that's it. You don't realise the impact it might be making. Then, you know, in the late 70s, I got, you know, asked to take over the Old Grey Whistle Test. So that was another huge leap thing, and I was doing newspaper columns. I was doing a programme for Radio 1 called Mailbag, which was, I must just tell you about that, because that was a real quirky show. It went out at 7 p.m. once a week. We had a producer called Juliet Blake, who has since become a Hollywood producer. She was always fantastic. And we were live at 7 o'clock. Her watch would stop exactly at 7 p.m. when the show started, and I said that there's some kind of electricity you have within you. I've never forgotten that. But anyway, we'd have all kinds of weird people on. Now, this was the kind of days, of early days of Frances Saunders, when they were obviously doing lots of their wonderful imitation, and they decided to be Duran Duran fans. Now, I knew everything about Duranis because they took over my Sunday request show, really, and they were one that I loved them. They were very witty and funny, and so Dawn French, Jennifer Saunders appeared on the show to be Duran Duran fans. Now, I knew because the real fans wrote hundreds of letters every week to me, and how neat their writing would be, and they would always put their fan club number on the bottom right-hand corner of the letter. This is pre-email days. So I say, in all kind of drollness to Frances Saunders, what's your fan club number? And they looked at me. I wasn't trying to catch them out, but they looked at me horror because they hadn't thought it through that much. You know.
Hello, Anne Nightingale here. Did you know that Simon Bates has got a thing about Mary Whitehouse?
Yes.
And David Jensen gets hot under the collar about nostalgia? Or that Captain Sensible hates cover versions? Well, lots more will be revealed on Wednesday on Mailbag at 7.
And there was that marriage of Radio 1 and BBC TV as well. Obviously, you were there on Whistle Test, but also Sight and Sound in Concert.
Yeah.
Jeff Griffin was producing that, and then you hooked up with Jeff on the Friday nights in January 1980.
Most wonderful fun with Jeff. I mean, I would come into Radio 1 during the week, and we'd sit in his office to talk through records, and I would be laughing from the minute I got in the office till the end. And I thought, and this is a living? And I mean, pay for this. I don't mean I was so privileged. He was so funny. I mean, he took the mic like you wouldn't believe. But I don't mind that. I quite enjoy that. And so we had people on that Friday night show. We just drifted, like Rowan Atkinson, Clive James, The Police. It was that era. So they'd be all trotting in and out all the time. A wonderful guest. It was like being Graham Norton, you know. But I didn't want to be this hard journalist who was going to expose who'd had a divorce and who was, you know, I just didn't want to do that. And so how could I stay working within music? And that's why the BBC has been so brilliant for me, you know. Without it, I don't know what would have happened to me.
Don't think about that now. Remember December 1982, because that was when you returned to the Sunday Request Show. But now, of course, it moved into the evening. You saw a fair few top 40 presenters off, didn't you, on that handover at 7 o'clock. Tommy Vance being the first, Simon Bates, Richard Skinner, Bruno Brooks, and there you were. And you stayed on it right through until the mid-90s.
That show was going to be a three-month filler.
Is that right?
Yeah. They just said, just play some records. No interviews, just play some tunes while they thought about what to do with that slot. So, obviously, I thought, we'll just play great tunes. And then they extended it and extended it and extended it. And it was the listeners' programme. I said, this is your show. You know, it's what you send me. And people would write lists. Every tune we go, that's great, that's great, that's great. You could do a whole program of this one person's list, but there may be one tune in there that you didn't know. You think, all the rest are great. I bet this, so I would discover things.
Anne Nightingale! Want to hear your personal favourites on Radio 1? Well, from Sunday onwards, that's just what you'll be able to do. I'm Anne Nightingale, and I'll be with you on Sunday nights, this time in stereo, from 8 till 10 o'clock. Classic rock tracks, all-time faves, the best of today's music. You name it, I'll play it. Requests on postcards, please, to Anne Nightingale, Radio 1, London W1A 4WW.
We don't know where those radio waves go.
Yeah.
It may be reaching out to space. You know, you get people in Australia or people South America and stuff like that. And, I'm absolutely blown away when that happens, because I think, how amazing, we can reach, you don't know where you'll reach you to. And that just is, it's just overwhelmingly, you know, that it's, I get very emotional about that.
Yeah.
But still, I feel exactly like I did on day one, but not quite as frightened.
Yeah. I mean, it was a huge part of people's lives.
Yeah.
And isn't it just so amazing to think that there are people up and down the country sitting in baths or doing their homework on a Sunday night, trying desperately to get it done before Monday morning?
Well, exactly. I used to say to them, look, If you fail your exams, that's your fault. If you pass, it's because you were listening to this, and yeah. I'm going to claim all the credit. So we had this sort of ongoing joke, but it was the right. I mean, so I think then maybe it had not been realised before that. And obviously, Top 40 is not on at that time anymore either. But that Sunday night, that was a very important slot. And they used to say to me, the first record you play is the most important record played on Radio 1 during the whole week, because you were trying to hang on to that Top 40 audience.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's why I didn't say anything. Banged the tune on, and we'd spent ages working out what that first tune should be. Sorry, it'd been a big hit within the past 5 years. Now, it might have got a minute and a half intro on it, or it might have 15 seconds or whatever. I wouldn't say anything until just before the vocal. And that was a whole high thing, and people couldn't work out when I was going to say it. Yeah. And it took people a long time to realise it was just about just before the vocal. Nightingale of Croydon used to write all kinds of weird things, and he used to send me paper, wicker mat, a prayer mat. I mean, it was all very dark art stuff. And it was a bit unnerving because he must have found out where I lived in Brighton. Right. And one day I went to go out of the house, and there was a box outside the front door, and no postman rung the bell or anything, and nobody else had gone in or out that day. So I thought, and it didn't have any stamps on it. I thought, this is either a prank or what, you know. But it was probably a time of, even then, heightened security risk. So I stepped over it, left it there. There was nobody else in the house at the time. Went and saw a friend who knew all about ballistics and explosives and stuff. So I said, what should I do? And he said, well, if you phone the police, this is what will happen. The whole area will be evacuated. And then they will do a controlled explosion, which is like a kind of caterpillar. They'll go up the steps and explode this small box, whatever, like a small hat box, whatever's in it. And if it is a prank, you're going to look very stupid. But whatever, I'll tell you what, I'll come around there. I went, no. And I can imagine him being, you know, blown to bits. But he did. Anyway, he opened it up. He shook it, first of all, and he opened it. And inside was like a turnip, and it had Happy Halloween from Night Out of Croydon. And I didn't know at that point whether he was sitting in some trees by a block of flats across the road watching. I never knew. And we never found out who he was. We thought he'd moved to Bexhill, which didn't quite have the same ring about it. But he had his, like, his own fans, you know. BBC Radio 1 and Wellington. Hey, hi, hello, Annie Nightingale here, so welcome you to the show.
And as you and I speak right now, we are heading towards your 50th anniversary. Yeah. On Radio 1.
Yeah.
So going all the way back, Annie, to that first show, 5th of October 1969. Yeah. You could never have imagined such a thing.
No, I thought I'd last a year max, if that. I mean, I say this anniversary starts next year because in 69 I started off doing... We were given a tryout, six of us, I think. And so they decided after that who was going to get to do anything a bit more permanently, but you still never thought it was going to last long, ever. And I think it was kind of, they did that to keep everyone on their toes.
Well, Radio 1's longest serving DJ by a country mile and then some. Can I say what an absolute delight it is that you've joined me?
Well, thank you for inviting me and finding some of these clips that I'm overjoyed about.
Annie Nightingale, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.